Okay. Chodesh Tov to everyone. Birshut my mom, who's Nana's daughter, who's here tonight. About a year ago, I have no idea how this is going to go, by the way. I know how that part is going to go. I don't know how this part is going to go. I'm trying something a little different this year. About a year ago, Gila and I went to a movie together. We had heard very good things about Wonder Woman, starring an Israeli woman named Gal Gadot, so we gave it a shot. Gila was so positively impacted by that film that a couple of months later, she took all five of our daughters to see it, hoping it would show them that women can be strong and gutsy while also demonstrating modesty in the true sense of the word. And while Yaffa, our seven-year-old, focused most of her post-movie energy creating her own magical bracelets and a cardboard sword and a headpiece, not to mention her perfecting the Gal Gadot Israeli-accented, "You should be ashamed," she had heard in the movie, the rest of the Jasper girls did feel empowered by the message of the film. And my bracha to my daughters and to Gila, my own Wonder Woman, is that they continue to grow in a life of Torah, able to impact the world in a positive way, to do their share to bring the Geula, and to help it progress along the path that has already begun. My reaction to the film was different. To me, it was a fun superhero movie with not an insignificant number of opportunities to feel Jewish/Israeli pride about all the other Amazonian women having to fake Israeli accents to match Gadot's. And Gadot's character saying, among other things, and I quote, "Where I come from, generals don't hide in their offices like cowards. They fight alongside their soldiers. They die with them on the battlefield." It's literally a line from the movie. Yes, Jewish pride. That's how I'd summarize my reaction to Wonder Woman. And a few months later, I began planning this year's memorial shiur in honor of Nana, Rivka Bat Pesi, my grandmother. And I thought, Nana was a Wonder Woman. She was strong, gutsy, and yet demonstrated modesty, both in terms of her appearance and her interactions with people. And I thought, I want to do a shiur about Wonder Women within the context of Judaism. But I'm a marketing person by trade, so I contacted Rav Ari Khan, and together we took a bit of poetic license and came up with tonight's topic, which is not Wonder Women, but the topic is Women and Mitzvot, Halachic Flexibility, a dispassionate look at an issue about which many are passionate. In years past, I've introduced the shiur by speaking a bit about Nana and telling a few stories about who she was. Tonight, since we've done this a bunch of times already, I'll minimize the biographical information and just tell you that Nana was absolutely a superhero to me and to my siblings. Sorry, Mom, to my siblings and to me. She was larger than life, even literally. She was 5'7", which was pretty tall for her day, for her generation. She was educated, yet provided us with such warmth and love. She owned a business, yet never let it stand in the way of us feeling like she was always there for us. And she rescued us so many times during the many challenges of our childhood years. Nana was a superhero. I want to thank my mom for being the one to make this possible each year, and I want to give her a bracha of health and happiness for many years to come. I also want to thank my sister and brother-in-law, Ilana and Liran, for being here from the States tonight, and I hope you guys enjoy it and are inspired by this. Rav Khan is, what can I say? He's a superhero in his own right, I guess. He brings Torah to life for me and for many others, I'm sure. He's always available for a halakhic question or for other advice. He's creative and interesting with a good dose of humor mixed in, and he's prolific. You never run out of Rav Ari Khan shiurim to listen to in the car on the way to or from work. I would suggest that he's a wonderful combination of artists and scientists when it comes to Torah, weaving together fascinating ideas that never cross the line, never compromising intellectual honesty. He didn't ask me for a plug, but I'll give one anyway. Buy his books, all of them. Go to RabbiAriKhan.com and listen to his shiurim, all of them. You will be more in love with Torah than you've ever been before. As I mentioned, we've done this a number of times, but this is also a first. We've done seven of these with seven different Rabbanim. This is the first time I've asked a Rav to return. And now I think you understand why. Thank you all for coming. I appreciate you taking some of your valuable time and giving it to us. And I hope you'll find it worthwhile. Rav Kahn.
So just one word of introduction. Don't go to RabbiAriKahn.com. Because whoever has been managing it has not been managing it. So just don't go to YU Torah and you'll find hundreds of shirim there. At some point, maybe the other one will be come back to life. I mean, the one hint that I knew that it wasn't really mine is that when it said the official Rabbi Ari Kahn's, but I mean, nobody would ever put up their own website and write the official, so you know it's not mine. Anyway, okay, so part of the challenge of this shiur is going to be, part of the challenge of this topic is going to be how serious to do it. So I want to give a couple of parameters and things to think about. Each mitzvah is its own world. Each Talmudic topic or sugya is complex with various Rishonim coloring it in different ways and not all of them having the same conclusion. I'm going to sacrifice a little bit in terms of precision because I'm not trying right now to explain one sugya with precision, but I'm going to be going through a number of different things, so therefore there's going to be a little bit of approximation. But the major goal is, in order to introduce, I think, the idea that we need to get to. I'm going to start with the story, I'm going to end with the story. The story begins, which looks like the oldest argument in the history of Judaism, and that is women of the wall. So I randomly Googled and seriously randomly just pulled out the first article I can find, which was from 2009, and lo and behold, there was Women of the Wall, I guess 2010 or 11 or 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 or 16 or 17 or 18 could have had the same thing. But in this particular case, Rav Avadia Yosef spoke, and he spoke as Rav Avadia Yosef sometimes did, and that was with a great deal of passion, with humor that only his own followers would have appreciated, and other people would have been outraged. And so it was a typical Rav Ovadia response, which caused then a response to his response by somebody who was one of the heads, if not the head, the mankal. I'm not giving any names here. You can Google the same way that I did too, of the reform movement in Israel, who decided that it would be his job to educate Rav Ovadia in terms of Jewish sources. I don't know if you realize how comical that is, but he said it a lot. I mean, the language on both sides was not nice. So we're skipping all of this and all the really bad things he said about Rav Avadia. As I said, it's just not dignified any place, certainly in a Beit Midrash. But along the way, he says he wants to remind Rav Avadia that most people, most Jews in the world are not Orthodox, they're Reform, which is actually not true. I mean, not that they're Orthodox, they're just not Reform. And then he, at the very end, in the last line, he says, V'neskir l'chvod harav, and I want to remind the Honorable Rabbi, Shagam Bito Shel Rashi Hit Atfa B'Talit. Rashi's daughter also put on a talit. And then his you have to love the ending, Yesh L'Shachrer Et HaKotel Shenit. We need to liberate the Kotel again. Okay. So I was amused a little bit this in terms of Rashi's daughter, but the truth is that everybody knows. Well, why do you only choose which daughter of Rashi? Rashi had three daughters. Which one of the daughters did he have in mind over here? And for that matter, of course, the larger question is why did he only mention that Rashi's daughter wore a talit? Why not just go straight to that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin? Because that... Now, I'm going to say something about that, and we're going to get to the very end. I'm going to come back to this. Just everything I say in the middle is going to... You're going to have to put up with it till I tell you what I'm going to say at the end. I don't believe, I hope that qualified in a good enough way, I don't believe anybody before 100 years ago ever made the claim that Rashi's daughters were talit or tefillin. Was that a clear enough statement? I challenge anybody to find it. I challenge any, again, today, Google it, you'll find everybody saying it. You'll find him saying it. You'll find everybody saying it. Everybody knows it. It's a fact. We all learned it. Rashi's daughters were tefillin. Rashi's daughters were talit. But I'll say it again. I challenge any of you to find a source which is more than 100 years old that said that. I don't know, is that at least intriguing or not at all? By the way, you realize where I'm going with that. Yes? I mean, there are many myths about Rashi's life. We all know that Rashi sold wine, right? Should I tell you that there's no evidence of that either? Rashi knew about selling wine. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik did make the observation that Rashi did not even live in the particular area that produced wine. Wine did not, or as Professor Chaim wrote at the end of that particular paragraph, he could have been a wine seller, but for all we know, he sold eggs. Just, we have no idea. But again, this is something which is commonly known. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows that Rashi sold wine. I remember once I was teaching that Rashi's opinion by B'chai V'nish L'Vsumei on Purim. People are obligated to get drunk on Purim. So Rashi writes L'Vsumei B'yayin. He writes with wine. So one of my cynical students said, of course Rashi said this. He was in the wine business. Of course he wanted people to drink wine. So now let's go back to the beginning. Rashi's daughters, and as I said, he had three, and his daughters produced a great many Balei HaTosfot. A great many of Balei HaTosfot came from Rashi's daughters, grandchildren, and so on. You don't realize when you learn through Rishonim how many of the Rishonim that are quoted are actually Rashi's family, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, that Rashi did not just produce books. He produced many, many, many followers. Just for example, we know about the Rashbam, right? Wrote a commentary on the Chumash. We know about Rabbeinu Tam. Did you realize they were brothers? Right? Rashbam, Rabbeinu Tam were brothers, and it was quite an impressive family. So let's go back, and a lot of what I'm going to do today is going to be based upon what Rabbeinu Tam believed, because Rabbeinu Tam, also another thing that we may not realize, in today's world, sometimes people get labels. They become the Posek Hador. I don't know what you need to do to apply to become the Posek Hador, but certain people get that title. Rabbeinu Tam was a more influential Posek than Rashi was. Rashi was a more influential commentary, but Rabbeinu Tam was a far more influential halachic decider, that Rabbeinu Tam said in terms of halacha, that had a great deal of influence. Rabbeinu Tam had somebody who he worked with, who was his ghostwriter, which all of us need. I'm looking for one, if anybody wants. You say I'm prolific. I've written 10 books. No, people don't believe in this. Thousands and thousands of pages with two fingers. That's how I write. And I know people, no, that can't, of course. My wife can absolutely attest to this. And sometimes only one finger, like if I'm drinking coffee, one finger I write with. So of course people can use a ghostwriter, and he had one. His ghostwriter was his nephew, a great-grandson of Rashi, whose name was the Ri HaZaken. Most of the Tosafos that we have on the Gemara is the Ri. So you have the Ri who learned with Rabbeinu Tam. They don't always agree. So they're going to be the main people that we're going to be looking at today as we proceed. And if we have the sources, we may as well use them. In source number one, we have the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah. One of the important parts about the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah is a huge Tosfot, which is going to be very significant, which I cut down into like three lines, which I'm cheating you, so you all can go back and say, I want to see that original Tosfot, and you're welcome to do it. Ein ma'akvin et ha'tinokot m'l'tkoa. Rosh Hashanah day comes, come home from shul, and one of your kids, who's not bar mitzvah yet, grabs the shofar and starts making noise. So now all of us, of course, know that you're not allowed to sleep on Rosh Hashanah, which, by the way, it says in no source. I'm sorry. It says it's from the Yerushalmi. There's no such Yerushalmi. So the Arizal says that even the thing about not sleeping is till Chatzos. Halavai, any of you get home before Chatzos on Rosh Hashanah. Okay? And the main consideration may be not to sleep early in the morning, to get up, because there's work to be done on Rosh Hashanah. So you come home from shul, you eat, right? I assume you don't have the custom of fasting, which some had. And then the kid starts blowing the shofar. So do you tell him, keep on blowing that shofar because I don't want to fall asleep at all? Or do you say, can you stop making noise? Or do you get frum, which is what some of us do? That's usser. It's muksa. Leave it alone. You're not allowed to blow the shofar. So that's really the question that the Gemara is dealing with. Ein ma'akvin et tatina kot m'litzkoa. But, unfortunately, what did the Gemara say? You don't prevent the kids from blowing the shofar. They're allowed to play with the shofar. They're allowed to blow the shofar. It's not considered to be muksa. On Rosh Hashanah, a kid can blow a shofar. Hanashin ma'akvin, but if a woman touches the shofar, boom, shoot her. That's what the Gemara says. No, it doesn't say that. But so that's real interesting, because why in the world should there be a distinction over here between somebody who's not bar mitzvah and somebody who happens to have two X chromosomes? So that would be the question. V'hatanya, the Gemara questions this. Ein ma'akvin lo et anashim v'lo et atinokot m'letko b'yom tov. Gemara says, no. You don't stop somebody, a woman, children, people can blow the shofar. Amar Rabbi lo kasha, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Shimon. Says, no, that this is really a machloket. We're going to see, this is an important machloket, that there's really difference of opinions here. On the one hand, is the one who says a woman can't is Rabbi Yehuda. He's the one who says no. Why there is a no over here, that's a real good question, but no. But Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Shimon say, yes, a woman can do this. Now, part of the question may very well be, is there some type of, now, I don't want to use the word mitzvah, give me a different word. Good karma created? No, mitzvah is a good word. But we have a problem with mitzvah, because the word mitzvah means commandment. So therefore, in halachic lingo, there's such a thing as a chiyuv mitzvah, there's an obligation to do a mitzvah, and there's such a thing which is called a kiyum mitzvah, a fulfillment of a mitzvah. If somebody wasn't obligated, can they still do a mitzvah? Now, technically, the answer is no. Why? Because they're not obligated, then it's not a mitzvah. What does the word mitzvah mean? Not like some people think a mitzvah, it's a good deed. No, mitzvah means it's a commandment. It's a tzivoy. That means that there is a God. There's a God who commanded. The God commanded, told you to do this. So therefore, God said to do something, that's a mitzvah. So can you do a mitzvah that you're not obligated to do? Because then, technically, in terms of language, I think we all appreciate, maybe that's not a mitzvah. That, by the way, is the whole problem. If somebody voluntarily does a mitzvah, Godol ha-mitzuva va-oseh, she'enu mitzuva va-oseh. But what is it called when you're not mitzuva and osa? So you're mitzuva and osa, you're obligated, you do it. What if you're not obligated? Did something good happen if you're not obligated? Can you still have a kiyum ha-mitzvah if there was no chiyuv ha-mitzvah? Can I ask you all a question this morning? Those of you who davened and said hallel, did you say a bracha? It may be dependent on the exact same issue. And now at least one person here knows why I gave a shiur on hallel and brachas on Monday night. No one else there knew why, because I didn't say anything else about it, but that was the reason. Is there, when you say Hallel, and you're not obligated to say Hallel, was there a Kiyum Mitzvah? If there's a Kiyum Mitzvah, so guess what? Then you can say a Bracha. Because what's the Bracha? The Bracha isn't on the Tzivui, the Bracha is on the Kiyum. Who did I lose so far? This really, hopefully, is not that complicated, but it becomes a very interesting question. So the Rambam, for example, says that if something's a custom, that means that there's no Tzivui. If there's a custom, you don't make a Bracha. There's no Bracha on a custom. Rabbeinu Tam comes and says, you do make a bracha on a custom. What I mentioned on Monday night is that part of this whole thing may be dependent upon somebody coming or not coming late to davening one day. Which I know sounds a little funny, but the Gemara in Tainus on Kaf Ches says that Rav, when he went to Bavel, he went to Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. So he walks into shul back home and he sees they're saying Hallel. Now one thing which becomes very clear from the Gemara is that Rav had never heard anybody say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh before in Israel. In Israel, the minhag was not to say Hallel and Rosh Chodesh. He gets there and they're saying Hallel. And he wants to stop them. And then he notices that they skip parts of Hallel. He goes, ah, so they just, it's just a minhag that they're doing. So now the question becomes, but did they make a bracha on the minhag? So Rabbeinu Tam plays with this back and forth and ends up concluding from all kinds of reasons that of course they made a bracha on the minhag. The Rambam says, you don't make a bracha on a minhag, and that's the whole thing. So presumably he came on time and he noticed that they said the bracha, but he didn't stop them when they said the bracha. I won't go any further than that. But that really is the issue. Because why would Rabbeinu Tam then say that you can say the bracha? Because there is a kiyum ha-mitzvah. What's the kiyum ha-mitzvah? That there's somehow something good happened when you said that hallel, even though there was no obligation. The Rambam again says no. Now this may all be dependent on something completely unrelated. It may be dependent on a whole separate issue. And that is, are you over an Issa D'Oraisa, have you broken the law by saying God's name in vain if you're saying a bracha that you were not commanded to say? Which may be dependent on another point. I'm sorry for getting so complicated, but we're just warming up now. It may be dependent on another point, and that point is saying God's name in vain a Torah prohibition, or is it only rabbinic prohibition? According to Rabbeinu Tam, saying God's name in vain is a rabbinic prohibition. According to the Rambam, saying God's name in vain is a Torah prohibition. So all the Sfaradim who won't say a bracha by a minhag is because to say God's name is you're breaking a Torah law. So you can't break a Torah law to do a minhag. A man who's Sfaradi can't say a bracha on Rosh Chodesh by Hallel. A woman who's Sfaradi can't say a bracha when she had no obligation to do that particular mitzvah. It's really the same. It has nothing to do with men, nothing to do with women. It has to do with understanding this piece of halacha, namely that according to the Rambam, saying God's name in vain is breaking a Torah law, and therefore you can't do it. When Rabbeinu Tam claims that saying God's name, quote-unquote, in vain, is only rabbinic law, so it's rabbinic law when applicable. And therefore, if there's some upside to it, then there's no rabbinic law at all, and then you can say the bracha, because you're not breaking anything by saying the bracha. So essentially, according to the Ashkenazim, there's no downside to saying the bracha. According to the Sephardim, there's no upside to saying the bracha. Did that make sense? That's a little scary. But do you now appreciate what I'm saying is that sometimes we're going to get to certain topics and it's going to deal with women and mitzvot, and you're going to look at it on the outside and think that this whole thing is about women, but it's not about women. It's about larger issues which are taking place, which is one of the reasons why this is really quite complex. I'll give you another example, and that's tefillin. A long, long time ago, men used to wear tefillin all day. Today, men are discouraged from wearing tefillin all day. Why? Because tefillin requires both physical and emotional consciousness and holiness. The current halacha sensibility is that most men, most of the time, do not have that type of physical and emotional holiness, and therefore they're encouraged to limit the amount of time they put on tefillin. Don't wear them all day. Only wear it during davening when you have to. Don't wear it a second longer. Now, when women ask, can we wear tefillin? So they're generally going to be discouraged. So I'm going to tell you a secret. I think the reason they're discouraged is the exact same reason that men are discouraged. Men are told not to wear tefillin 1 second longer than they normally should. A woman's not obligated, so the same thing. Again, it has to do with upside versus downside over here. So if you look in the Ramban, what he says about women wearing tefillin, do you know what word he says? He doesn't say aloud, he doesn't say not aloud, he doesn't say us, or doesn't say what. Do you know what he says? Discouraged. Why does he use the word discouraged? For the exact same reason that men are discouraged. So I'm going to say it again, that this is another time that somebody reading that will tend to look at this as being a topic which is addressing women specifically, when it may not be addressing women specifically as much as it's addressing tefillin specifically. And that's why this whole topic is going to be so much more complicated. And even though I gave you 6 pages of sources, which was cut down from my 14 pages of sources, because I had a little compassion for you, but even so, I hope you understand what I'm saying, is that there's so many topics, and that's why I said again, I'm going to be imprecise. I want to try to explain things in a more general sense, but realize that if you're going to ask me about any one particular issue, you're going to come to understand that that issue is not necessarily an independent issue about women and this, but it's actually interrelated with different things, as now you appreciate, for example, the whole tefillin discussion, men being discouraged, the whole saying of God's name, which, again, upside down side, Rabbeinu Tam, is it a deraita, is it a drabanan, and so on and so forth. We're all good? So over here, we learned something else now, that in terms of the Tanayim, there's the machlokas. What's the machlokas? You have Rabbi Yehuda who's saying that a woman should not do a mitzvah which she's not obligated. Apparently, according to Rabbi Yehuda, again, no upside, only downside, don't do the mitzvah, but we find a machloket. And the machloket, who's the other side of the machloket? Rabbi Yossi and Shimon. What if Yossi and Shimon say, a woman wants to blow the shofar, blow the shofar. So why not blow the shofar? Well, they're generally on Shabbat. Are you allowed to blow the shofar on Shabbat? I'll ask you a bad question. Yom Kippur is almost over, right? But it's not over yet. Can the Baal Tzur Keh blow the shofar? Well, you have to wait for the... I know every year people are looking at me like I'm crazy. And you say, it's still Yom Kippur. How can you let this guy blow the shofar? Well, it's after Shkia, so don't worry about that. You don't want to know my reasoning, by the way. But it's not really Yom Kippur anymore. Okay, but it's enough of Yom Kippur. But there's no Isser Malacha blowing the shofar. It's not an Isser Malacha. It's one of these things which is like a cliché and something. It's called a Chachma in the Gemara, but it's not called a Malacha. So it's something that we generally don't do, but therefore for an adult man or woman, there's a downside unless there's a kiyum mitzvah. So an adult man blowing the shofar, there's a kiyum mitzvah. If for an adult woman there's no kiyum mitzvah, then there's only a downside, not an upside. So what conclusion then do we have from Rabbi Yehuda? Don't do it, because there's only a downside, not an upside. On the other hand, for the kid, there's a mitzvah chinuch still, so mitzvah chinuch, so therefore they became an upside. So that then becomes the understanding of Rabbi Yehuda. But what about Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon? Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon apparently understand that for a woman to blow the shofar, even though she's not obligated, there's an upside to it. Why? Apparently, they both understand that there's still a kiyum ha-mitzvah. There's a kiyum ha-mitzvah, so then it comes underneath the general rubric of vitzivanu. According to them, and this is, again, I'm using Rabbeinu Tam to explain the Tanayim, it could very well be that when God said to Am Yisrael to do something, women, believe it or not, are included in Am Yisrael. So therefore, when God says to do something, so the vitzivanu goes on Klal Yisrael, so women can say vitzivanu the same way that a man can say vitzivanu. So therefore, when a woman takes a shofar, there is a kima mitzvah. There's a kima mitzvah. She could say a bracha. She should say bracha. There's no downside to any of this. But you say bracha levatala. No, there's no bracha levatala because that's only drabbanan. It doesn't apply in a case where there's a kima mitzvah. Are you impressed that now you understood everything I just now said? Yeah? As I said, this all sounds as if it all makes sense, which is really quite frightening. So let's then continue a little bit more. The Tanya, as we learned in a Braita, Dabero b'nei Yisrael. And this is talking about the mitzvah of smicha. So that's part of what we're going to talk about women in smicha. But it's not what you think. It's talking about the mitzvah of smicha when you bring a korban, when you press your hands on the animal when you bring the korban. Actually, all joking aside, with women of the wall, that's the oldest machlokas in Judaism. So hold on, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Still, the Gemara here in source number one continues and says, the Tanya, we learned in the Braisa, Dabero b'nei Yisrael, B'nei Yisrael somchim ve'ein b'nos Yisrael somchod. That this mitzvah of smicha is only on the men, but it's not a mitzvah on the women. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda understands that smicha is the archetypical case. We have, by the way, you can now ask, okay, so who cares? It's by smicha. What did that tell me about shofar? Apparently, the Gemara's understanding over here is that Rabbi Yehuda's opinion by smicha applies over here as well, and that's a leap, which we really should explore, which we won't explore why that leap exists. Nonetheless, it says that's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. That means women are excluded from the mitzvah of smicha. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Omrim, Nashim, Samchot, Rishut. If they want to, they can do it. So right over here you see an example from the Gemara. The Gemara is exploring the question of shofar. Can a woman blow the shofar? Just stop, blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. Rabbi Yehuda says no, but Rabbi Yehuda's consistent says a woman can't do smicha as well. And Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon said yes, and the Gemara is assuming here that these are related. Yeah. As I said, he uses it here, and there's an assumption that it applies in other cases. I said that. I said, why that assumption is true is a very good question. So I said, perhaps this is a paradigm, perhaps not. Again, that question I'm not exploring, but that is a decent question to ask. Is this for some reason the case that goes in every case, or not? Okay, the assumption is that it is. Well, Rishut is certainly to be contrasted with Rabbi Yehuda as saying not allowed, so that's at least the way it's being used here, but let's continue a little bit. Source number two, which I'll just tell you quickly what this discusses over here, it's the Gemara in Brachot, which explores the issue of a woman saying Kiddush. Here, what's the reason? No, it's mitzvah sheshezman grama. So therefore, a woman. But again, the same question is: can she say kiddush? Is she obligated? Not obligated? And we'll skip through this right now because that just as easily could have also been a paradigm. Let's leave that. Even though there would be reasons to make it different. Number three is the Mishnah in Chagiga, which will be the starting point for the main discussion. The Mishnah says, Yosi ben Yozer Omer Shalol Lismoch. Yosi ben Yochanan Omer Lismoch. Rashi in 4, Yosi ben Yozer Omer Shalol Lismoch, B'yom Tov. V'zui machloket rishono shaita b'chachmei Yisrael. This is the first argument, which then goes on generation after generation. Question is, an animal is muktza, there's a mitzvah to do smicha. This should be a no-brainer, that the mitzvah of smicha should outweigh the problem of touching the animal. And that's the argument that took place. Does it outweigh or doesn't it? Maybe, when the rabbis made up a din d'rabbanan, that you're not allowed to touch, move, or animals, so maybe it even overrides a deraisa. So again, that's very interesting. Maybe a din d'rabbanan overrides a deraisa. So before you ask me anything else, let's just read the Mishnah quickly. Again, source 3, Yosi ben Yozer, Omer Shalol L'smoch, Yosi ben Yochanan, Omer L'smoch, Yeshua ben Prachya, Omer Shalol L'smoch, Netai Harbaili, Omer L'smoch, Yehuda ben Tabi, Omer Shalol L'smoch, Shemim ben Shetach, Omer L'smoch, Shemaya, Omer L'smoch, Avtali, Omer Shalol L'smoch, Hilu Menachim, Lo Nechlaku, Yotza Menachim, Nechna Shamai. It's as if we need the machloket. These guys aren't arguing, let's get rid of it. Right? Shamai, Omer Shalol L'smoch, Hilu Menachim, L'smoch, Harishonim, Ho Yunisim, Ushnim, Lahim, Avot Beitin. So we see generation after generation after generation, this argument existed. Source number 5, which is the Gemara explaining, so the next page, Amud Bet, explaining this. Yotza Menachem is the Shammai. So the Gemara has to ask, Lehechon Yotza, where did he go? Abayama Yotza L'Tarbit Ra. He went off the Derech. Rava Amar Yotza L'Avodat HaMelech. He went and got an official government position. They could be the same, by the way. Okay, I'm sorry. Tanya Nami Hachi, similarly it was taught. Yotz Menachem Levodat Melech, V'yotzi Imo Shimonim Zugo Tamidim Levushim Sirikim. Amrav Shimon ben Abba, Amrav Yochanan la'ol matiyah shvut kala beinecha. Don't ever underestimate the power of the rabbis to say certain laws that you shouldn't do something on Shabbos. It's not Shabbistic. It's not appropriate for Shabbos. Sharei smicha ain't ela mishum shvus. The only reason not to do smicha, not to press on the animal, is because of the shvus, because it's something which is not appropriate for Shabbos. And we find not just gdolei ador mentioned for what was this, five generations. We find people arguing about this. Pshita shvus mitzvah is truchile. But the question is, what about it to shvus when it's facing a mitzvah, which is the case over here, where again I talk about upside and downside. That do we keep this idea of shvus or do we do the smicha? So what can I conclude from all of this? That the way that you do smicha, it must be that you press on the animal with all of your might, because that's the problem. That's where the problem is in terms of using it or pressing on an animal on Shabbat. So that seems to be what the concern is. Because if you were to think that you don't have to use all of your strength, so what's the problem? Lismoch. Meaning, if you just touch the animal, the Gemara is assuming that's not a problem. So therefore, again, as a side point, assuming that it must do it all your might. Meitve. So it says, let me now question. Now, notice, this is introduced as a side point. The main point was smicha, not smicha, on Yom Tov, meitve. Daberu b'nei Yisrael. V'samach. B'nei Yisrael samchim ve'ein b'no Yisrael samchot. You should recognize this because we just saw this. Rabbi Yossi, here it says Rabbi Yishmol, it's really Rabbi Shimon, Omrim. B'no Yisrael samchot reshut. So again, we have the same language, reshut. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Now, before I read the next line is what my whole shir is about. Sometimes we have situations where you have one Tana says this, and one Tana says this. One Amora says this, one Amora says this. Every now and then, you have what's called a Maisa, or Maisa Rav, a case that actually happened, which supports one of the sides. So here, till this point, we have a Machloket. Rabbi Yehuda, as we all know, said, no, not allowed. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon saying, yes, allowed. This Rabbi Shimon, by the way, is Rabbi Shimon by Yochai. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon say yes, Rabbi Yehuda say no, it's Rabbi Yehuda bar Ilai. These are among the five... the three of the five students of Rabbi Kiva after he lost his other students. And he says, Sachli Abba Elazar. Their assumption of the commentaries is that it's not that his father's name is Elazar, but it's somebody whose name was Abba Elazar. Sachli Abba Elazar, he told me, Pamachad hayalanu egel shel zivche shlamim, vivinhu le'ezrat nashim, v'samchu alav nashim. Once upon a time, it happened in the Beit HaMikdash that there was a korban, and it was brought to the Ezrat Nashim, and the women did smicha on it. Not because they're obligated, this goes back to the Rishut now point, not because they're obligated, in order to make the women happy. By the way, when was the last time you heard a rabbi use that as a consideration in a psak? Let's make the women happy. Now this, you realize now that this is really what's important in this whole discussion? Because he brought just now a case, and this is what really happened one day. This is what happened in the Beit HaMikdash, and I assume that the Beit HaMikdash, you'll tell, oh, there were the Stuki Kohen Gadol. No, there were Orthodox rabbis in the Beit HaMikdash, and the Orthodox rabbis decided, that, yeah, this is a good thing. Let's bring this in. Now, of course, the question is going to be, what price was paid for this? Which means, what just now happened? Was a law being broken? Part of the Gemara's consideration, was it b'kol kolcho, with all the strength, not with all the strength? Is any law being broken? Rashi suspects that there's a problem maybe of baltosef. That if you're not obligated to do something, you do something not obligated, maybe there's a problem of baltosef. Maybe that's the downside. Tosfot assumes the problem will be is that a woman is doing kudshim. She's doing avodas kudshim in the Beis HaMikdash, and that's something which is not allowed. So the Gemara is going to end up saying, well, maybe they didn't do it with kol kolcho, maybe they did it with part of the kolcho, but that may still be the problem of doing smicha, which was the machloket that went on for five generations. And what I'm trying to get now, not just to overcomplicate this for you, this is the part which is complicated. What is the problem? Which means, what exactly did we just now see? What do we understand from what we just now see? Or more importantly, what are the conclusions from this? The Gemara really stays with this, that, it, yeah, you You're going to tell me that this is really have to do with all your strength. You're going to tell me just to make some woman happy, you're going to let her do something which is about a kachim? So I'm going to say it again now. The contours of this Gemara are complex. Instead of trying to figure out the pshat now, I am abandoning all responsibility to explain the Gemara properly. This is what I was hinting at before. But what I prefer to do now is to say, so what did Rabbeinu Tam do with this? That's, as I said, I think is the more central issue. Skip Rashi. Tosfot source number 7. Lasot nachat ruach lanashim. V'kagon shaita behema shelahen. It was one of the women's, it was her korban. Doma l'smicha l'hoya b'bailim b'perakama de kedushim b'perak batra de Rosh Hashanah. Pirish Ri, this is Rabbeinu Yitzchak now. This is Rabbeinu Tam's nephew. The Nashim Didan, what does that mean? Nashim Didan? Our women. What he really means is women in our times, today. Nashim Didan and Boat Lasot Mitzvah Taseh, Shazman Groma, Ulivarech Aleim, Ein Memachim Biyadim, Afagav Dipturot, Ulo Mikri Bracha Livatala, Bechain Mashva Mehacha, Vaot Pirashi Hatam Biroshana Beharachim. So he said a couple things here. He says, from this Gemara, this is really where we build the argument that if a woman wants to do a mitzvah, let her do the mitzvah. Why? Lasot nachat ruach l'nashim. That's really what comes out from this particular Tosfot. And I'm going to say it again. This is the read. This is Rabbeinu Tam's nephew, Rashi's great-grandson, who's saying this, is that women in our day, if they want to do a mitzvah, fine, do a mitzvah. If you want to do a mitzvah, say a bracha on it. And why? Because he understands that there is this, again, he said along the way over here, yes, he touched that. He said, "V'lo mikri bracha levatala." He didn't get into the reasoning for it. I already told you the secret why it's not a bracha levatala. Because Tosfot understands the bracha levatala or shame Hashem is only drabanan. So there's no bracha levatala. I'm going to say it again this way. There's no downside as far as he's concerned. And therefore, when women ask, can they do mitzvot? So the answer is yes. You do recognize that this is a real far from saying that his grandmother put on tefillin. Right? That's simply not what it says. But what he does say is that this is the sensibility which existed in the world of Tosfot. And notice the last thing he writes at the end of Source 7, Va'od Pirashti Hatab Rosh Hashanah Veherachti. He goes, I wrote a lot there. So here's where, in Source number 8, I only put 4 dots at the end, but that's his harach. He goes on and on and on and on. It's the rest of the next 2 pages, if I would have put the whole thing. But we got the main part, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Amar Rabbeinu Tam. And what was the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah? That's where we started. That was the Gemara, can a woman play with the shofar or not play with the shofar? Amar Rabbeinu Tam. So now, not just the read. This is the read now quoting Rabbeinu Tam. Because we already got the hint it was him writing. Because he says, Shem Herachti. I wrote about it there. So this is really the rewriting of telling us what Rabbeinu Tam said. Amar Rabbeinu Tam. Afal gav destamat nitin k'Rebbe Yehuda. Generally, we assume the halach is like Rebbe Yehuda. Halach k'Rebbe Yossi. In this case, the law is like Rabbi Yossi. Now, we didn't know that before. Now we know that what's the law like Rabbi Yossi? If a woman wants to blow the shofar, a woman wants to do smicha, she's allowed to do it. Dinimuko imo uma eserav damotzi tefillin. And there's also various cases that we have that support it. He's actually going to a different case, a case in Erevin. Michal bat Shaul haitama nechit tefillin v'ishtol shoyona shaita ola l'regel v'ahu uvd deperek ein darshin dehevin hula azirat nashim v'tsamchu olav nashim kedei lasot nachat ruach l'nashim u'mutarot l'varecha mitzvah taseh shezman gara af agav depturot min adavara mitzvah hi u'mitasot behen. So again, we have Rabbeinu Tam here saying the exact same thing that the Re said, so I'll say it again. We have now some more consistency. Rabbeinu Tam gave us the reason. Why? Number one, halacha is like Rabbi Yossi. Why is halacha Rabbi Yossi when it's normally like Rabbi Yehuda? Because we have various Talmudic stories that tell us cases where women went and performed mitzvot that they were not obligated to perform, while Yehuda's sense was it's asur. The others said that it's Rishut, and we see that they do it, but they added another level to the Rishut, which was actually your question. They added another level to say, no, not just Rishut. They can say a bracha on it, because, again, for them, which is really a separate topic, no downside, so you can say the bracha, Klal Yisrael, were obligated, so therefore, women in our day, now we have both Rabbeinu Tam and the Re, both telling us the same thing. The only question is going to be over here is how long you want me to talk, and how many sources you want me to bring that say the same thing. The Rosh brings the same idea over here. He quotes Rabbeinu Tam, and it says the same thing. At the very end, he also quotes the Ritz Giyot as saying the same thing. Lach is like Rabbi Yossi, and women can make the brachot. In source number 10, it's another Tosfot, a Tosfot in Erechin. And over there again, it says, quoting Rabbeinu Tam, the same kind of thing. By the way, that's the way Tosfot ends. Psak. word, right? That's psak. This is the halacha. And again, it's the same thing again and again in Tosfot. I don't know how many Tosfot there are in Shas that just say the exact same thing, and that's that without even getting fancy, going to the Tosfot Arush or going to the Tosfot Yeshanim or other places, although we will get fancy in one place. Source number 12, we're going to take a detour, and the detour is going to be something which is one of these rumors that have long persisted, and we're going to see what to do with this. This is the Rav Yah. The Rav Yah is from the later school of Tosfot. The Rav Yah comes and writes, we're going to skip the whole beginning over here, top of page 3. The Hanashim Nahagu Silsul Ba'atzman Uprishut Be'et Nidutan She'in Nichnasot Lebeit HaKneset. So let's pause for a second. The whole first part of the Rav Yah, which I skipped, he was talking about all kinds of tum and tahor that exist today. A man who's a balkeri, a woman who's in need, all kinds of things. And his basic approach was, the words of Torah do not get affected by tum'ah, and therefore there's no problem whatsoever. A man can pray, a woman can pray. All of this is a non-issue. But then he threw in at the very end, one more consideration. He says, Nashim Nahagu, women have a custom. So this is going to give us another insight into what was going on in Ashkenaz at the exact same time of those other sources that I told you. Women had a custom that when they were nida, they wouldn't go into shul. I don't know if you ever heard of such a halacha, but it says that's what the women did during that time. Now, why would you do this? You would look at the shul, the Beit Knesset, as being like a Beit HaMikdash. There is a real halacha that a woman is tameh or a man who's tameh can't walk into the Beit HaMikdash. But that doesn't apply to a Beit HaMikdash Katan. That doesn't apply to a shul. There, nonetheless, there were people who looked at the shul as being holier than it was. I apologize for saying that. And they took the laws of the Beit HaMikdash and they transferred them over to the shul. And therefore, these women had the custom not to walk into a Beit Knesset when they were nida. They wouldn't even pray in front of anybody else. They would be isolated. Now that's actually of a whole other story. There is a Braita, which is called Braita Dinida, which is a very, very strange Braita, which does not exist in real authoritative sources. I'm just saying there is a rabbinic text that sprung out of, I don't want to say nowhere, because obviously there's a history behind it, but that's what he's referring to over here. And then he notices that, and he notes it. The Rav Yah writes the next line, the Einu B'Tosefta Shelanu. This Braita which I've seen is not in it's not in the Bavli, it's not in the Rishalmi, it's not in any of the Midrashim that we know, but there is this collection, and this collection takes a lot of the laws of Tuma and Tara, and they apply them in the Middle Ages. Which, again, halacha or minhag? What's the answer? Minhag. What kind of minhag? Minhag of trying to ascribe to get to levels of holiness. This is a religious issue, but it's a spiritual issue, but it's not a halachic issue. But such a thing existed. I don't have to fill in all the places because you know that there have been Jews who've been looking for spirituality in all kinds of places over the years. And this is an example of, I'm sorry for putting this, halachically it's an imaginary issue. But just because it's imaginary doesn't mean that it didn't exist. There were people who decided that this is the way that we need to conduct ourselves. And as I said again, you can all fill in all the blanks and understand yourself. But what the Rabbi is telling you, it's a non-authoritative rabbinic source that says this, but yet there are people that are doing it. Clear? The kosher minhag. The Rav Yah now made a value judgment, and it's a kosher minhag. Kedemrinan, abal keri, shamati shemekilin bov, shamati shemachmirin bov, kol machmir bov, marichin lo yama vishnotav. And now he just gave a little bit strength to it. Then you want to be machmir, it's a good thing to be machmir. Abal keri, before he got, by the way, that's the minhag. A lot of people have not to go to daven in the morning unless they went to mikvah. Like chassidim won't go until they went to mikvah. Every single day they'll go to mikvah. Why? So this comes back from this kind of sensibility. And by the way, I'm not saying that there's no Talmudic source for something about this. I'm just saying this is really a middle age sensibility. And sometimes it gets a little confusing. Trumat Hadeshen. Trumat Hadeshen is one of my favorite shelot for tshuvot. He liked it if someone was being machmir and going to mikvah. That's what he thought. It goes back to Takanas Ezra, which again, I don't want to get into right now, whether it applies, does apply. So it rings a bell by the Rav Yah as having something positive to it. Right, go to mikvah. Right. Trumas Hadeshen. Now, why do I like the Trumas Hadeshen? He wrote Chayos and Shuvos. He made up all the questions. Nobody asked him any of these questions. Do you ever suspect that rabbis do this? They make up the questions and they give the answers? He did. He made up all the questions in the book and then he gave answers. He actually loved the questions. Although that's a really good question. And then he gave answers to it. Trumas Hadeshen writes as follows. Va'ala nashim ba'et nidatan, emet hitarti lehem b'yimei ha'noraim, Okay, we just now got back to our Nachat Ruach Nashim. So we had this strange minhag that women didn't go to shul. So what does he say? But in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you're going to be machmir. You're not going to go to shul in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur because you're machmir for some kind of funny minhag that you're needy. You're not going to walk into shul. And he writes, why am I using Nachat Ruach Nashim in my argument? By the way, it's a very strange image that he's presenting to us now. That all the nidot are standing outside in the corner and all the other women are sitting inside. And it just creates, no, I'm saying it just creates, and he says, no, and that's what Truman is actually, he goes, stop, just stop. So now it's interesting. So what did he pull out of left field to stop this? He said, Nachat Ruach L'Nashim. It's not right for somebody to feel distressed and standing outside. Come inside the shul, ma baya. So this is a very interesting tshuva, but it's more interesting than you think because it actually makes its way to the Shulchan Aruch. So that's why this is particularly interesting. And let's leave that and go. The Beit Yosef in 14 quotes the Goat Mamanu to quotes the Rav Yoh that we saw, who then quotes the Trumat Hadeshin that we just now saw, and we'll read the Shulchan Aruch instead, going straight to 15. Kol Hatzmeim Karim B'Torah V'Korim Kriyat Shema Palalim Chutz Mibalei Keri Shotziu Ezra Mikol Hatzmeim V'Asru Bein B'Divrei Torah Bein B'Kriyat Shema Tefila Ad She'Yitbol. Anybody who's Tamei can learn Torah, read Torah, do anything, except for Balkeri until they went to Mikvah. Kadesh Shelo Yeh Tamei Chutz Mitzvim Eitzan L'Shutem Ketar Nigolin. Not for now. V'Avkarchach Batlu Oto Takana, and then Takanat Ezra was cancelled. V'Midu Adavar Al Din She'Av Balkeri Mutar B'Dvar Torah V'Kriyat Shema V'Tfila B'Lo Tfila U'V'Lo Rechitza D'Teisha Kabin, basically a shower. V'Chein Pashar Aminag. So what did he say? That there were various stages in Jewish history when the Takana Ezra applied or didn't apply, and I'm going to say it again. The whole sensitivity to this point is really one of a Beit HaMikdash law and not Divrei Torah. Divrei Torah, not Makabal Tuma. So the Ramah, Hagah, this is now moving to Ashkenaz. Yesha katvu she'en la'isha nida b'mei riyata likanes l'beit ha'knesset o l'palel l'skir Hashem o ligaba sefer. Any of you ever heard a rumor like that? If a woman's in either, she can't touch a sefer? So he just now said this. He said, there are those who claim such a thing. All of this comes from that strange work that I told you about, which is not authoritative. There's no Gemara, there's no Mishnah, there's no Breita, there's no Tosefta, there's no Midrash Halacha. All of it is imaginary. So he says there are some who claim this imaginary law. And some say, no, all of this is allowed and that's the law. And who does he quote of all people? Rashi. That's already the Tumat Hadesh and Olta. That's Rashi said, all of this is allowed. Which means that Rashi stood up against these rumors, these people who were trying to bring extra laws. No, one second, would you all agree we have enough laws of Tumat Torah, we don't need extra ones? So that's what Rashi said. Maspik chalas. By the way, this is like, as close as we're getting back to Rashi now. Aval haminhag binot eluk esvar rishona. So even though he says it's allowed, the Ramah just told us there are a lot of people who that's still their custom. Go convince a woman that she's allowed to go to shul when her mother told her she shouldn't go to shul. This is a very interesting Ramah. And then he writes, "We may libun nogu heter." You may libun means when they're not actually menstruating. He said everything here except for that one line that we wanted him to say. But he quoted, that's the Truman Edition. So the Truman Edition that we saw before, by saying, no, of course they can go to shul. The Ramah brings us halacha. So even if you want to be machmir, don't be machmir in Yom Kippur. Go to shul Yom Kippur. Don't stop. And that's really what the Ramah just now said. Take a look at the Gra, source 16. And those of you who don't know me, the Gra little comment is almost as important or more important than everything else that we've seen. Just listen to his turn of phrase. The ones who say you can't do it, what does he label that? That is a chumrali alma, which he's basically saying it has no halachic basis whatsoever. Chumra be'alma. And then he says, "Gidei lasat nachat ruach l'nashim, v'af agav dekorev la'avode bekodshim kol shkein kain." Which means the Gra just now went back to explain the Gemara for us, that a woman is allowed to do smicha even though it looks like she's doing avodos kodshim. And he says, that's allowed. The Gemara just now told us what the conclusion was of that, the Gemara, when it says lasot nachat. You with me? This just may be a little bit harder. He told us that that Gemara says that we allow the women to do the smicha even though it looks like she's doing avodos kodshim. We let her do that. He said, hold it, a woman's doing, stop her. You can't let her. No, we allowed her. And he goes, certainly over here to let her go to shul when there's a made up imaginary chumra, of course she can go to shul. What are you talking about? In source number 17 is Hilchot Yerideya, Hilchot Sefer Torah. Kola tameim afilu nidam utorim lachos b'sefer Torah propo. That's the halacha. No, nothing else. And just in case anybody ever told you that it said that any other, yeah, women had a custom. That custom, the Gra says, is no custom. You want to know what halacha is? It doesn't mean as much as you think that it means, because lekrot over here means literally to read from a Torah. I mean, there weren't other books. So a woman wanted to learn Torah. She could take his Torah scroll, open up the Torah scroll, and sit and read the Torah scroll. But you say, no, but she's a nida. She can't touch a Torah scroll. Shulchan Aruch never heard of such a thing. So I'm saying, Shulchan Aruch in Yerideya, which is Hilchot Sefer Torah, yeah, so of course a nida can touch a Sefer Torah. There's no problem with that. But there was an imaginary custom by some women in Ashkenaz who thought that they couldn't even walk into shul because, as I said, taking the laws of the Beit HaMikdash and applying them. So I hope that this point is clear. Where do we go now? That's the question. I'm skipping a little bit more because I know that some of you are getting tired. Source number 20. This you're going to like. Yes, this is one of the three reasons you came tonight. Source number 20 is at Tzemach Tzedek. Anyone ever hear the Tzemach Tzedek? Yes? Who? Yeah. There were two Tzemach Tzedeks. If you ever want me to give a shiur about fish, I'll give a shiur about the other Tzemach Tzedek, which is very interesting. And both names are Menachem Mendel. Apparently, without even knowing it, it has to be that Menachem Mendel and Gematria is Tzemach Tzedek. It can't be the two Menachem Mendels named their book Tzemach Tzedek, and it doesn't work out. So you can try that at home, but it has to work out. The Tzemach Tzedek was one of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's. And listen to what he's asked. Should I translate that? When a woman wears tzitzis or talus, should she make a bracha? I can't wait for you to ask your next shliach that you bump into this particular question. He quotes our whole sugya, and you already know the whole sugya, so we're not going to read the whole thing. He gets into this point about smicha and about so on, about touching the animal, and he says, Lasot nachat ruach lenashim. We'll move towards the end of it. Ein afuljun tzarich lomer da'af shetorah asur lahen smicha gemura mishum avodah kodshim. This is three lines from the bottom of source 20. Even though the Torah didn't allow them to because of its kodshim. Mekomakam lo bnei zeh lo natna lahem reshut b'mashein bo isur davodah kodshim kagon b'afika yadayhu. We didn't get that far in the Gemara, yadayhu, which means what if they touched it but they didn't push it with all their strength? So they weren't breaking any law. So there really is no real downside to it. And that's what it means that a woman wants to do smicha, she can do smicha. V'kolshkein v'kal v'chomer, you like that one second? V'kolshkein v'kal v'chomer, how would you translate that into English? V'kolshkein v'kal v'chomer, sheyesh lomo kein b'mitzvot tzitzit, v'yesh gam kein l'kayim mitzvot tzitzit, k'din mamash below shum kalayim, k'gon v'talit shel tzemer, ol shel sharminim l'fidur, and so on. He just said, yeah, of course a woman could put on, of course they can wear a talis, wear tzitzit and so on. By the way, it's not Rashi's daughter. It's not even a granddaughter. It's not even a great-granddaughter. But the Tzemach Tzedek, just as a... See, I want to point something out, and this is parenthetical, but the parentheticals are going to be more important than anything else that I say today. We live in a very funny time. We live in a time where there is something which scares many, many rabbis, and it's called feminism. And there's something else which exists, which is open orthodoxy. So therefore, you have to be very careful any psak that you give, because how are people going to understand it, how they interpret it, and what it's going to mean. And the question also here becomes, so what happens if I throw out all kinds of cliches and all kinds of terms and all kinds of issues, and I go back to, so what does halacha actually say about something, or more so, what exactly are the tools in the poseg's tool shed? That's really what I wanted to get to. What are the tools that the poseg has? So there's a really powerful tool that he has, and what's that tool called? Lasot nachat ruach lenashim. So we just now saw a really interesting application of it. I'm not going to go through every single posek and every single point in history who used it, but I'll give you one example. How many of you women, I know that sounded terrible, how many of you make a shachianu on chag when you light candles? Or how many of you don't say shachianu because, yeah, how many of you do? Almost all of you do, right? So I'm sorry for what I'm going to say, The proper thing is that a woman not say Shachianu when she lights candles. Doesn't make a difference what I'm saying now. You do tomorrow, next time, whatever you did last time. The proper place to say Shachianu is on the coast. What's the reason that they let women to say it then, even though it's not in the proper time? Guess why? They want to say it, so let them say it. I mean, it's not a terrible thing to do. Okay, so go ahead and do it. But I'm saying, again, it comes to this point. It's not perfect, but there's no downside. So go ahead and do it. There was somebody who, again, without going, the Talmud of the Ramah was am I right about it? Talmud of the Ramah was questioned regarding somebody who's blind and having an aliyah of Torah, which basically he can't read the Torah. So of course he can't get up and have an aliyah. And he says, he goes through our sugya. And he says, but we allow certain things. So of course you can allow this guy to have an aliyah. Meaning what really is the problem? And I can go through a list of applications where people utilize this. So I want to do, let's say, two more things. Yes, you have strength, time, or yes, no, maybe? A little more? 10 minutes, I'm just warned. Source 23 is Tosfot Talmud Rabbeinu Tam. This is another one of Rabbeinu Tam's students telling us what Rabbeinu Tam thought. Godo mitzvah ba'ose, misha enu mitzvah ba'ose. That was our question before. If you're not commanded, is it still a mitzvah? When it says gadol mitzvah, so what does that tell you? That there is some kind of, yes? Gadol means it's better, but doesn't mean it's absolute terms, it's nothing. So gadol mitzvah means it's better, but there's still something being done, even if you weren't commanded. Aval mitzvah yeshlo, mikan nagu ha-ga'onim la-tir l'varech l'nashim, al kol mitzvot aseh shezman grom, kagona yeshivat sukkah, v'netilat lulav, v'al kol mitzvot she'enun chayavot, v'ein kan bracha levatala, k'demash mahacha, she'af al pi she'enun chayavot, mikol mokom yesh la mitzvah. V'ein nir lo Rabbeinu Tam. You didn't expect that, right? After everything else. Rabbeinu Tam? No, it doesn't make any sense. V'ein nir lo Rabbeinu Tam nishmato eden. So what else do you know about Rabbeinu Tam at this point? He's already no longer with us. Sh'rei heich yomru v'tzivanu mi'alcha she'enu mitzvot. So Rabbeinu Tam is arguing on everything that till now we thought was Rabbeinu Tam by saying, how can you say that? But, now this is what I've been telling you the whole time. The one thing I just now added is that Rabbeinu Tam was not brought up with this necessarily. There was a shift in Rabbeinu Tam's thinking. Earlier in his life, he believed a woman shouldn't, and then he changed his mind, and he decided that she can, and part of that decision was because of this technical point, that there's no downside, namely that it's only Drabbanan, it's not a deraita to say God's name, and therefore she can say the bracha, and it is a little more complicated than that, and you have a very long toast for Talmid Rabbeinu Tam for your homework. Source number 24, we need, and before we read 25, I'm going to have to tell your story. Source number 22, we're going to go backwards. I want you to see this. Because remember I told you the arsenal that rabbis have and things that they can say and then the questions how they use it? Source number 2 is the Shevet Levi. The Shevet Levi was Rav Vosner. Rav Vosner was a wonderful posek. We lived in Bnei Brak for like 60 years. But he was the Rav of Bnei Brak, but he was from Bnei Brak. So he's asked over here, is it appropriate, let's go to the end of the second line. All that he wants to do is to pass the Torah by the women and so they can kiss it on Simchat Torah. So what's his conclusion? He goes to the whole sugi and he comes up, so of course you can do it. Right? They do worse things. They did smicha on the korban, but at the very end he comes out. One second, we'll get to the end of this, where he ends up saying at the top of page 5, Mikol makom letaken lam takanazot lo nira l'niyataiti. Just doesn't seem to me to be appropriate. So what's my answer to this? Again, I think this is really interesting. All of his logic came to the point, of course there's no problem, of course this is allowed. But in Bnei Brak, he's saying, I don't see any reason to do it. Now, I hope you appreciate that a different rabbi in a different neighborhood, in a different community, with different expectations or different sensibilities, could come to the exact opposite, can read this tshuva and just have a different bottom line. His bottom line is, well, of course that's allowed. Why? Because there's no reason not to. You potentially can go a bit further than I'm going right now, but I'm going to leave you all to your imaginations, but I just want you to see that was Rav Vosner saying, but there's no reason not to, but I just don't know why yes. That was basic. I just can't imagine why yes. I don't know, at least half the people in this room could probably tell me why yes, right? But He just didn't see any reason to go any further. So now you get your story, and then I get my last source, number 25, which I did not find until Saturday night, very late Saturday night, I found it. And I searched harder than I should have, and I found an old book that had it. And then I said, you know what, let me look over there, and I had it the whole time on my computer. But first the story. A number of years ago, my wife was sitting Shiva, and the phone rings, and somebody who is actually the world's expert in Rashi calls up. His name is Professor Avram Grossman. Today, he's fortunate that probably many people here may know him as Yoni's father, right? Which is funny, Baruch Hashem. I'm sure he'd be very, very proud of that. I was once sitting in a room with him and with his cousin, Rav Yitzchak David Grossman. Both received Pras Yisrael. Cousins and another member of the family was there as well. Very, very special people. Avram Grossman is, as I said, he's a professor, retired Hebrew U, Pras Yisrael, a prince of a man. Humility, cares, decent, nice, very proper. So my wife is sitting shiva, the phone rings. One of my sons, many to choose from, phone rings, and the voice on the other side says as follows, Midaber Avram Grossman, Afshar Ledaber Im HaGeveret Naomi. So my Israeli son holds the phone wide like this and says, Ima, yesh eiz achnun ba-telephone. Translate. There's a nerd on the phone. Why? Afshar Ledaber Im HaGeveret Naomi. I mean, that was a little too much. So when I heard that it was him on the phone, and he called to wish his condolences, I told her, don't hang up. So I said, I want to talk to him. So when he finished, she hands the phone back to me. So I said, Rashi's daughters. World's expert in Rashi, right? Who are you going to ask? I said, Rashi's daughters. What's the story with tefillin? So he says, there's no such source. So I said, so where'd it come from? He said, I have a suspicion. And he sent me a paper. I lost it years ago. So that's what I was searching for, because I knew what I was looking for. So now you have it. Nobody else has this. No one knows about it. You have it. I don't even know if this is what he told me about. He may have sent me something else, but I knew what I was looking for, so source 25. We're going to go to the second part where it's underlined. Even the women don't have to blow the shofar, because Pirish the token lanoshim levadim uverchim lahem. V'chein pirish Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yehuda. Now that name unfortunately means nothing to you. Am I right about that? It's very sad. Who is Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yehuda? One of Rashi's two teachers, which means that the Psak Halacha already went to Rashi's Rebbe. Now I could be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, because obviously a name like there's more than one Yitzchak ben Yehuda along the way, but I'm 98% sure that this is Rashi's Rebbe. Who paskin this way, which means it's not just from Rabbeinu Tam or from the Re, it's already going all the way back another generation to Rashi's Rebbe. And if you remember before, someone said, V'kein pasku ha-ga'onim, and ha-ga'onim doesn't always mean the ga'onim, it could have meant one of the earlier sages, and this is my suspicion that we have at least Ritzik, and he may not be the only one, there may have been others as well, who we see, demut l'kol nashim u'levarech, but he mentions him a number of places in Chas. He says, Rabbi, Ritzik, he quotes him a number of times, but it's not his father, no. And so on and so forth. Skip a little further. This is also, we don't want to go into it all, that a woman can call up for the Torah. If they're called up for an aliyah, they can make the bracha. So also, I'm sorry for bringing this, because you didn't want to see that. V'ra'ayami Michal bat Shaul, which we saw before, shaita lo veshet u'manachet tefillin, v'ishtol shayona haita ola l'regel, u'mitam ze nagu miktsat nashim tzadkaniyot laniach tefillin u'lavreich latataif b'tzitzit. And because of that, there are a number of nashim tzadkaniyot who were, this Moshav Zakenim is a parish on the Torah from the Bali HaTosfot. So this is Tosfot speaking and saying that in our lifetimes, there are women who are putting on talis and tefillin, and what does he call those women? Nashim tzadkaniyot. So where did the rumor of Rashi's daughters come from? It was mathematical. We know that during the time of Rashi, more or less, Balei Tosfot, there were nashim tzadkaniyot who put on talit and tefillin. Who's a bigger tzadeket than the daughters of Rashi? So it must have been the daughters of Rashi. That leap does not exist in any early source. This is as close as you're going to get to Rashi's daughters putting on tefillin. It just doesn't say it. It says nashim tzadkaniyot. Of course, today, if any woman put on talit and tefillin, we would not call them nashim tzadkaniyot. we would call them something else. So even though the head of the Reform movement was not necessarily right when he reminded Rav Ovadia that everybody knows that Rashi's daughter put on a talit, or for that matter, he could have added a tefillin. So it's actually not true that they did, or there's at least no evidence that they did, or Rashi could have been an egg salesman, or all kinds of other things are possible along the way. So what it is that we try to do tonight? What I try to do is to take you a little bit into the world of women and mitzvot. What I try to show you is some of the complexity and also some of the possibilities. I try to show what the main sugya is, which really comes down to smicha. We find already from the Tanaim that there was an argument of that between Rabbi Yehuda and between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. We find that the Baal HaTosfot decree, the halacha is like Rabbi Yossi, and we find that there's a story there, that Maaseh that happened at the time of the Beit HaMikdash, because of something which was very important. Lasot nachat ruach l'nashim. So now what I'm going to say is that this does give the posek leeway. It gives the posek an ability. Now how much ability and where you draw the line, so that's where it gets much more complex, because it's going to depend on the nuance of exactly what happened in that Gemara. And that is not necessarily agreed upon by everybody. Which means when it's something, it's not in the minhag. Let's just start with that. It's not in the minhag, but, okay, I don't think it was the minhag to do smicha, and they let them do smicha in the Beit HaMikdash. So you see, even when we go to Rav Vosner, who wasn't about to allow women to bring the Torah into the Ezra Nashim, he didn't say it's not allowed. He said it is allowed, but I don't see any reason to do it. But if he felt there was a reason to do it, he would have done it. So the main thing I wanted to get to is that there is a kli, right, which I'm not defining. I'm leaving this all very amorphous. There is something which Poskim can use in certain cases, which is Levi Nachat Ruach L'Nashim, which is a real bona fide thing. And you saw the way the Gra used it. That was interesting. He goes, let them go to shul on Yom Kippur. Of course they can go to shul on Yom Kippur. There was no Isser. I mean, the real case is that we let them do smicha. I mean, that was far more interesting as far as the Gra was concerned. How far you use this may end up depending on all kinds of socio other issues and who you are and which group you are and who you belong to and what your agenda is. And that's all the things that I try to avoid. You know what I'm saying? I try to avoid all of that, but rather, that's what I told you, a dispassionate analysis of what the sources say and getting a better sense of what the parameters are of where one could possibly go with this. But as I said, the posek then, the responsible posek, is then depending on what the question is asked, what the community is, now you realize that's significant as well, can decide what the upside is, what the downside is, and how they make the applications on how certain things can be done. But I can assure you, there were Nashim Tzadkaniot in the past that did far more than the Nashim Tzadkaniot did today. And there were Nashim Tzadkaniot in the past who were very, very machmir in a different direction and wouldn't even walk into shul because of the imagined sitkut. So again, the past is a funny place also. It's not just the present which is funny. Your wife is here?
My wife is here.
She will explain it to you later. It's essentially saying there's no downside, so why not? But it's going a little further than that possibly, but it's saying this is worthwhile. It's saying that maybe even I'm going to sidestep a possible Issur Rabbanan because there's enough upside in this of a woman having religious experience. I'm saying we're not used to rabbis speaking like this, so it's very interesting to find the Gemara speaking like this and Rishonim speaking like this. Thank you very much.